that? Wyndham just told you that. Shut up, he yelled to you, Shivani. Why don't you just let me broadcast? Why don't you listen to Wyndham and shut up?
From Television City in Hollywood.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
The following rustic exhibition requires discretionary viewer participation.
Greetings from Allentown Estate in front of a live studio audience.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 81, Greetings from Allentown. I'm your host, Peter Winson, and today, I'll be taking a look at WCW Worldwide from January 23rd, 1993. Time and place, I've not gone back to any of the Tony Schiavone and Jesse Ventura Worldwides in far too long, I don't think. It's been over a year. I think it was episode 23 that I did one from May of 1994, just before Hogan came in. And my plan is to do back-to-back WCW shows because, number one, I've been watching an awful lot of 93 and 94 WCW lately. I don't understand why. It's just one of those things where it's what I've felt like watching. Or maybe it's been showing up in my YouTube recommendations. I don't know. And also, despite doing this show for almost a year and a half now, I've never done two straight WCW shows. Like, I've done as many as four consecutive WWF shows, but never two WCW or, you know, incorporating JCP, because, you know, it is the father promotion to what WCW eventually became. Yeah, never done that. And that was the plan, but it's going to change somewhat for reasons that I'll get into eventually. First, let me get in my usual plugs. You can email the show, greetingsfromallentown@gmail.com, facebook.com/greetingsfromallentown. Reach me on Twitter. Give me a follow there, @GFAllentownPod. And you are probably listening to the show on the new and improved Pro Wrestling Only feed in association, sort of, with Place to Be Nation. Pro Wrestling Only has certainly been revamped, the website, ProWrestlingOnly.com, by Charles over the last couple of months. And he's put a lot of labor of love into it with match reviews and all that. So if you go to ProWrestlingOnly.com, you'll notice a lot of changes in the site when it comes to the way the podcasts on this feed are promoted, so looking forward to big things from that perspective. And while, you know, I put over the other podcasts on this feed, I have to mention this because I forgot to do this in last week's show. You may notice that I have podcasts that I'm friends with, particularly the Our Vantage Point podcast and the Wrestling Podcast About Nothing, and I forgot to promote them last week. And I'm very sorry about that because Wrestling Podcast About Nothing was talking about Killer Kowalski and his legacy because it's the 10th anniversary of his passing. Around this time in 2008 is when he passed. And the Our Vantage Point podcast this week, with their 97th episode, looking at the year 1997, during one of their segments, they're kind of going through the various years in the 90s, which a lot of fun. Which I'm kind of doing with the TV themes at the top of the show, with the Dukes of Hazzard representing 1981. I'm probably not going to hold to that as I keep going forward, but I will do the sports thing at the end of this segment, just kind of pulling one sports moment from that particular year that I'll discuss a little bit. And speaking of podcast friends, I met up with Steve Bennett, my occasional podcast partner on the Adams Division podcast. We've done pods on WrestleMania, Royal Rumble, and on his list for the GWWE for Place to Be Nation earlier this year. Hung out in Cambridge after a little snafu where I could have sworn he told me he was staying at the Royal Sonesta, so I drove there and sat out front for 5 minutes, like, wondering, where the hell is he? I'm like, the only car here. And like, no, we're staying at the Hyatt down the street. So I drove down to the Hyatt and like, all right, where are we going to go? And we're in Cambridge, Mass, which just across the river from Boston. I could have driven into Boston, and I know places to park there. In Cambridge, one of the reasons why my wife and I don't go out to eat in Cambridge very often is it's a real pain in the ass to find parking, particularly on September 1st, where you got a move-in date for a lot of the universities around, you know, apartments. The lease will start on 9-1. You can't get a rental truck, and it's all kind of chaotic and all that. But at this point, it was 8 o'clock at night. So it took like 20 minutes to find a parking space for going to this place called Cambridge Brewing Company, which I particularly enjoyed. I've been there with my wife several times. I would name a beer of the week from there, and but I can't quite remember the name of the beer that I had. It was named after Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin, which was interesting in that it was a 3.6% alcohol by volume beer, and it was from a cask, which I found rather fascinating that you had a beer that low, because also on their menu, they had a 14% ABV beer, which usually you get up to that level, it's basically port or whatever. But, you know, we split some nachos and whatnot and chatted about things. His brother Greg was there as well, and a couple of his friends came and joined us later as well. So a good time had by all. Now, as for the rest of my weekend, I did not go to Pearl Jam, which is what Steve was up here in Boston for on Sunday. And it's a good thing I did not do that. And more on that on next week's show, because I'm going to have to record that early, so I will tell you the story of what happened to me on Sunday night into Monday. A few of you listeners who I correspond with personally may know what happened to me already, but I'll get into more of that later. As for why I ended up doing a January 1993 WCW show, other than the fact that I find this point in time to be interesting because it was around this point in time where the light bulb was starting to go on for Bill Watts, no pun intended with any of that, even though, and I've never had these kind of cross in my mind, that Bill Watts is still there when they're mentioning the White Castle of Fear challenge with Vader and Sting for Super Brawl 2, because Watts doesn't go out the door until February. He's still very much in charge. But also, in seeing the YouTube video on there, you get the little picture that gives you a screenshot of something from the episode, and it is just Tony Schiavone and Jesse Ventura. And I've said in the past, I find them to be perhaps the most underrated team of all time, because it's always Vince and Jesse and Gorilla and Jesse that get all the headlines, but Tony and Jesse certainly made for a very good combo, and I think maybe that Tony had his best chemistry with Jesse because he knew how to roll with what Jesse was doing from a joking perspective, and then Jesse also jumping down his throat, and which he certainly does during this show, even though it might not have been what Bill Watts wanted from Jesse as a color commentator. You can imagine that given the large contract that the body was making, that Bill Watts certainly wanted to get rid of him, but it was probably ironclad and there was nothing to do. I mean, you might as well use him if you're going to pay. So I watched the Clash of the Champions from January of 93, which was Clash 22, which has a Bill Watts interview where he actually says that Eric Watts is like a son to me.
You've got to understand that I've had a great relationship with all my children, and Eric has always been like my son.
It was something to that effect. It wasn't that exact quote, but that was what I got out of what he was saying, because he was suspended for that show for the infamous gas station fight with Arn Anderson, where he put Arn in the STF. Not the worst thing that would happen to Arn during the year 1993, but still not particularly great. But if you watch that Clash 22 show, and I thought it to be a very easy watch, a lot of the Clash of the Champions doesn't really get bad, in my opinion, until you get into 95, where I don't find any of the ones after that point to be really worthwhile. Although, with that being said, I've never watched the Hogan Flair Clash from 1996, from after Road Wild. I've yet to check that one out, although I'm sure I will at some point in the future. But if you watch Clash 22, I swear, you would think that Too Cold Scorpio absolutely ruled the world at that point in time, mainly because Sid wasn't around, and we all know that he is the master and ruler of the world. But Scorpio had a match on that show, but also had the great music video with the Too Cold Scorpio theme that was so great, and one of WCW's best themes. And they had just come out with the CD of their, I forget exactly what they called it. I didn't write it down. And quite frankly, it's not that important, because beyond Scorpio, they didn't have a lot of great themes. He's actually on this episode of Worldwide facing off against the Barbarian. Now, I know that there's a lot of different Barbarians, but once you get down into 93, the one true Barbarian is Sione, the guy from the Powers of Pain. So just to make that clear. But also, another thing that attracted me to this show is there isn't a lot of, let's say, enhancement matches. There, you can tell who's going to win these bouts, like Barry Windham versus Brad Armstrong. You kind of know where that's going to be going, but Brad Armstrong is a pretty good professional wrestler, as is Barry Windham still in 1993. He's on his way to winning the NWA title in February, which that's a whole thing that I'll get into during that match, because I question the wisdom of Bill Watts kind of turning to the NWA. Kind of, maybe I should incorporate All In here with Cody Rhodes winning the NWA world title. And I noticed that the title belt looks very much like the license plate one that they had in like 84 and 85 when Flair held the belt. Only time will tell if that kind of leads to anything in the future. I think if you're going to have somebody as that champion to kind of lead the way, you might as well have Cody Rhodes do it, which would be a name at least that people would know. Even if he's not, like, say, the number one professional wrestler in the world, people know that he is the son of Dusty Rhodes. Sorry for that bit of a tangent there. We also see the favorites of Center Stage Theater in Atlanta, Tex Lassinger and Shanghai Pierce, taking on the World Tag Team Champions of Ricky Steamboat and Shane Douglas. But this is actually taped, as this is Worldwide. This was taped on January 6th, so only 17 days before. 93 would be the year that they would notoriously start taping 3 months ahead of time down in Florida at the MGM studios down there. But at this point, things were a little bit tighter, I'd say. So Montgomery, Alabama on January 6th. And we also get a recap of Clash 22, the Thunder Cage match that was main eventing that show there, an update on the United States title tournament, as Rick Rude had been stripped of that title shortly after Starrcade 92 due to an injury, which had a little bit of controversy to it. But anyway, with all that in mind, let's just jump right into the show. Well, that's two consecutive hockey ones that I've done, but baseball had a strike that year. The NBA was just getting going under Bird and Magic in their second year, and the NFL, there really wasn't a whole lot in 1981 to point to, so I pulled that, which is actually from the very end of the year, December 30th, 1981. The Edmonton Oilers are facing the Philadelphia Flyers, which I'll get to why I'm laughing in a second. And Wayne Gretzky, coming into the game, has 45 goals in 38 games on the season. Nobody had ever scored 50 goals in less than 50 games. And in the game, he scores 5 goals, capped off by an empty netter with virtually no time remaining, I think 1 or 2 seconds left. So 50 goals in 39 games, a record that's not even going to be touched ever unless they make the Nets really big or something like that in the future. The closest anybody has come is Mario Lemieux with 50 goals in 44 games, and Cam Neely also had 50 in 44 for the 1993-94 Bruins as well. But, you know, the goal scoring in the NHL was way up back in those days, but Gretzky was so much better than even anybody else So it's really just kind of a testament. Now, the reason why I was laughing, the Philadelphia Flyers thing, this was during the very brief period, it was either a season or two, where the Flyers wore long pants. You know, you watch hockey, guys wear like these short pants, it padded and all that. There was a brief period from 1981 through 83 where a couple of teams, the Philadelphia Flyers and the Hartford Whalers, would wear long pants. So they had like, it's kind of strange, kind of like the pants that referees would wear. And they look kind of ridiculous in retrospect. I remember in my very early years in youth hockey, a lot of kids wore that. And I never did. And in fact, it eventually got outlawed by the NHL because guys would end up sliding on the ice and they wouldn't be able to control themselves and they would either go into the boards or whatever. So that was something that fell out of the NHL at the very least in 1983. And it's all for the best. It's really tough for a hockey fan like me to watch a player like Bill Barber wearing those ridiculous pants. So anyway, we go to the intro, and I can assure you that Jesse Ventura is definitely taller than Tony Schiavone. I know a lot of talk of Tony would have to have his seat higher, but Jesse, I don't think Tony was going to challenge him because Jesse is kind of towering over him with the backwards hat and all that. And they throw it to a clip of the great Muta winning the NWA World Heavyweight title off Masachono at the Tokyo Dome on the annual January 4th show, which was not known as Wrestle Kingdom at that time. It was just the January 4th Dome show that was a tradition and then would become Wrestle Kingdom much later on. And Bill Watts felt that the NWA name, as I said, but kind of like this all-in thing from last Saturday, that name still held some sort of prestige. And maybe it's my own feelings about the NWA and how it was a cartel, you know, created to drive out competition. But I just don't get it because it really hadn't held any sort of prestige dating to the mid-80s. So you're talking years, even in 1993. Once Crockett assumed control of the title and Flair was kind of the standard bearer champion for much of the mid-80s, save for the Kerry reign that was 18 days and really only happened because David passed away earlier in the year. So kind of creating a feel-good moment. He doesn't lose that title again until 86 to Dusty, and even that's only a 3-week period, and also a guy who is in Jim Crockett Promotions. So I don't know, maybe somebody can explain it to me why you feel that the NWA name might have held some prestige in 1993, let alone today, given that Billy Corgan is the guy who runs things for the National Wrestling Alliance, and I don't even want to go down the whole road of his history in wrestling. So instead, we will go to our opening match, which is Too Cold Scorpio taking on the Barbarian, former number one contender to the WCW World Heavyweight title at Halloween Havoc. And kind of interesting by good old Barbie, he comes to the ring and he yells, "Huss." I don't know if this was some sort of tribute or signal to the Berserker to come join him in WCW and become the Barbarians or something like that. He also is coming out to very familiar music, as this was the Diamond Studs former theme from 1991, which I thought was rather interesting and indicative of a WCW recycling program that had been underway. It was nice to see that they are doing that, but he's not the story here. Too Cold Scorpio, the man who ruled the world in early 1993, and the fact that that theme that he had at that time. How on earth did this song not chart? It's an indictment of the failures of WCW's promotion at that time. Let's think about the music scene in early 93. You got Snow with Informer way up there on the charts. And, you know, he was pretty horrible by any standard you want to pull out. Jamie freaking Walters, the guy who played Ray Pruitt on 90210, had a number one hit coming out of that The Heights show that only lasted 4 months. So how could this Scorpio song get overlooked in the long run? But We were kind of in a weird place at that time, I do have to admit. And Scorpio dances in the ring. It just reminds me, Vince McMahon probably saw him doing this at some point and said, "Goddamn, pal, I've got to bring this guy in, and he's got to dance for me, and I've got to laugh." Kind of a shame that he got saddled with the Flash Funk moniker in late 1996 when he finally does get to WWF. I think he has spoken about how when he got there and he started making bigger money, he was kind of reinvesting those funds into drugs, which is kind of an unfortunate consequence of when you find yourself coming into money. It really kind of makes me sad. And I did propose many, many episodes ago a different gimmick for him in the WWF rather than Flash Funk, where he would basically be the sheriff from Blazing Saddles rather because, you know, he had an enormous penis, or so the legend goes. And just thinking of him in WCW at this time, you think if Bill Watts sticks around, and Bill Watts always loved to push at least one African-American superstar, you got Ron Simmons, who they'd just taken the world title off him right after Starrcade 92. They went back to Big Van Vader, and that's fine. So you're probably not going to go back to Ron Simmons figuring, well, that's a failure. But if you promote Too Cold Scorpio correctly, I was just thinking, wouldn't it have been great to see matches between Scorpio and Vader? I think those two guys would have had pretty good matches. And they did have one match that I found on YouTube. Unfortunately, it was in 2012, so long after anybody else would have been interested. So yes, Scorpio dancing in the ring, and Jesse takes the first of his many fun slaps at Tony Schiavone.
Well, the man can dance too, Jeff. Take a look at this.
Well, he looks a lot better than you do, Schiavone. Last time I saw you in one of them goat roper bars after a few too many.
What were you doing in that bar, too? All right, set to go.
Watching you dance.
I'm sure you were.
You don't want to go in front of that judge. I caught him in a drag club.
What were you doing there?
Wow. You should be the lawyer.
That's always the best comeback to have when somebody questions why you were someplace. Just throw it back on them. What were you doing there? Like with Jesse and with Barry Zuckerkorn. Scorpio uses his quickness early on with a couple of drop kicks and then hits a missile drop kick off the top rope. And I should mention that a lot of talk of the Bill Watts era goes back to the nothing off the top rope rule, which was very early on in his reign and got reversed in pretty short order. I think more of the time that Watts was actually in charge, you could do top rope moves. Once he kind of figured out that wrestling had evolved, because he was away for 5 years, and that was kind of the issue I think he had early on, especially when you got guys like Scorpio or even a Steamboat who had been doing top rope moves for years. It seemed like kind of a silly rule to have. Goes for the Hurricanrana, but is caught into a powerbomb, which Barbarian kind of holds him there for a bit, and then does the move. Then he gets Scorpio up in a body vice, which Too Cold then spins out of, and then nothing happens. Which is kind of funny, because then he puts him up in the body vice again, the reverse backbreaker position, and then he rolls up Barbarian as a counter for a two count, which made me wonder, did they have to just do the spot again a second time? That's usually not a good sign. Maybe I'll put that on the Barbarian, because after all, like I said, Scorpio ruled the world in early 93. Scorpio is sent out over the top, but there's no DQ, as explained by Tony, because he went out on his own momentum, which is one of those deals where, again, the over-the-top rope rule was completely pointless by 1993. It should have been done away with in the mid-80s, when using that as a finish was just antagonizing the audience every single time you would do it. Sunset flip back in, but Barbarian grabs the rope, and then he just kind of lets go of it for whatever reason. They didn't do the stupid spot where the referee kicks the Barbarian's arms as if, you know, the referee's kick can knock Barbarian's arm off the rope. And Jesse accuses Scorpio of grabbing the tights to get him into the sunset flip. A belly-to-back suplex followed up by a corkscrew leg drop, which only gets a one count for Scorpio. Kind of interesting there. And then a super kick by Too Cold. I have to say, huge difference in the offense between Scorpio and the Barbarian. I'm usually pretty high on the Barbarian as a big guy, but he is not impressing me at all. Maybe 93 was just a down time for him, and Scorpio was looking really, really good, and he actually hits a slingshot 450 splash, which really looked good, but Barbarian actually kicks out of it and then suddenly just backdrops Too Cold Scorpio over the top rope for that finish. So now they actually do call the DQ. I just hate that finish so much, because what does that accomplish in this case? It's not like if the Barbarian loses on this episode of Worldwide to Too Cold Scorpio, it's going to hurt him that much. It certainly would have helped Scorpio, I think, at least a little bit. You got your babyface just out there laying. He kicked out of was not necessarily his finisher, because the 450 off the top rope was more of his finisher. But this is a finish that absolutely helped neither guy, especially the guy that you're going to win. And beating the Barbarian here via a pinfall wouldn't have made a bit of difference anyway. It's just really annoyed the hell out of me.
Welcome to the first edition of the WCW Magazine. I'm Eric Bischoff. Heavy Metal Van Hammer has suffered a setback in his career.
He stinks, and I don't like him.
In this day and age, it can be difficult to get any sort of unanimity on one particular thing, whether it be in professional wrestling or not. But it seems to me that Van Hammer, there isn't one person that I've ever known who really, really liked that guy. And if you want to come forward and confess that, more power to you. But everybody seems to have hated the guy and thought he stunk as a worker. And he couldn't take part in the arm wrestling contest at Clash 22. He missed it against Vinny Vegas, which Hammer had beaten him previously. But Vinny Vegas was all like,
"Why are you smiling?
Because I know something you don't know.
And what is that?
I am left-handed."
Yes, good old Vinny, who we're going to hear from later, said that he was left-handed, so he was at a disadvantage. So he got to face Tony Atlas instead. Yes, Tony Atlas in 1993, and he beat him in an arm wrestling match going left-handed. Then I get a review of what went on in the Thunder Cage, which is a concept that I liked. I liked the look of that steel cage in part because you had the holes that were bigger than the chain link fence you would ordinarily see on WCW programming. So it presented better on TV. It had a much higher ceiling than the old War Games cage, so there wasn't any chance of any more Pillman incidents where he's going to hit his head on the cage and nearly die on the way down. But it is the circumstances surrounding this match that gives it a definite WCW kind of feel, because this was originally supposed to be a 4-on-4 match. Sting, Dustin Rhodes, Ron Simmons, and Van Hammer against Big Van Vader, Barry Windham, The Barbarian, and Rick Rude. Well, what happens is Van Hammer's got to drop out because he's injured, as we've already established from him not taking part in the arm wrestling thing. Rick Rude had to drop out because he had the injury that led to him vacating the U.S. title. Then you have Rick Rude being replaced on the heel side by Paul Orndorff. Okay, fair enough. The babyfaces never replace Van Hammer. So it's going to be 4-on-3. So you figure, okay, you're just going to do the match that way, and you're going to have the babyfaces overcome the odds and somehow win. No, instead, they do an interview segment on on The Clash where they just beat up the Barbarian out of nowhere to make it a 3-on-3, which doesn't make any sense because they had a man advantage. They should have at least kept him around unless they thought he was some sort of, I don't know, spy for the babyfaces. It would seem weird for the Barbarian to be doing that. I mean, that certainly doesn't make any sense to me, but fine. They're going to be the 2011 Boston Bruins. They don't want to have a power play. By the way, they went 0-for-21 on the power play in the first round and still won the Stanley Cup. So that was the first thing that came to mind when I saw that. So we're back to 3-on-3, and Ron Simmons gets attacked in the course of the show because he goes out and confronts Vader, and he gets injured by Vader in the aisleway right before the match. So now we're down to 3-on-2, and while you're waiting for the heels to beat up somebody else, who knows if they're going to turn their wrath on Barry Windham or something like that. No, they're going to go ahead, and they're going to do the match 3-on-2, but the story that they're building was towards Cactus Jack's babyface turn, which kind of goes back to Starrcade as I recall, where he was getting a lot more of a babyface reaction for the character that he was. And the official face turn really comes when he breaks in to the cage with a set of bolt cutters, which is now way overdone whenever you do that whole bit. I mean, it kind of takes away the whole purpose of the cage match, but back in those days, you would not see it that frequently, so it meant a lot more. I also like how Jim Ross, who was calling that clash, it's kind of strange to hear Jim Ross in 1993 WCW, because he's only there in the beginning of the year, calls him the Bizarre New Mexico Madman, which I guess kind of justifies me doing the show right before I go to New Mexico. And he hits basically everybody with a boot, evens it up in a three-on-three situation, and eventually, you know, leads the team to victory. As Cactus comes off the top rope, Orndorff is going for a pile driver in the middle of the ring, and Cactus comes off with that boot and hits Orndorff with it. And you gotta say, Mr. Wonderful, always very vulnerable to stuff off the top rope like that in, you know, a main event of a super show. Just think back to WrestleMania 1 with Bob Orton's cast, something like that. And Cactus Jack, as a babyface, it was certainly very organic the way it was created, but he paid a big price after doing that turn, because it led eventually to taking that horrific bump on the floor, the Vader power bomb, and then the Lost in Cleveland stuff, which I covered back in episode 48. So it wasn't without its bad things going on, but overall, turning Jack babyface was a pretty nice story in my mind.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Steamboat and Rose, oh my gosh! They both go over. Steamboat all the way to concrete. Rose landed on the apron, but more importantly, perhaps, in the contest.
Wait a minute, Steve, it's Wendell!
It's Barry Wendell! Barry Wendell!
And that was how Dustin Rhodes won the United States title tournament that originally aired on WCW Saturday Night on January 16th, so 1 week before this, beating Ricky Steamboat via countout, which feels like kind of a cheap way to win. But once again, whoever was doing finishes in WCW seemed to be really into callbacks. Yeah, my one about Orndorff, that might have been something of a stretch. But here with Steamboat, this points to an exact moment earlier in his career, because you hear Barry Windham comes out, he DDTs Ricky Steamboat on the floor, no padding, because, of course, Bill Watts, we don't have none of that blue padding or anything like that, like those wimps up in New York. So Steamboat, calling back to that Saturday night's main event match against Jake the Snake Roberts in May of 1986, when he took that hellacious DDT on the floor. So he gets counted out right after that. Dustin wins the U.S. title. Kind of an odd way to end a babyface versus babyface match, but I guess it sets up a Barry Windham, Ricky Steamboat match down the road, perhaps even Windham versus Dustin Rhodes, something along those lines. And I had written down, was this Dustin's first singles title? He'd only been in the business about 5 years at this point. But actually, no, it was not, because he had won the Pro Wrestling from Florida title in 1989, in May of that year, as Dusty Rhodes, his dad, was out the door and heading for New York, as they had revived the Florida territory when Dusty was kind of between jobs after being fired by Jim Crockett Promotions, and then before going to the WWF. So maybe a little hint of nepotism in Dustin getting that title back then. And speaking of nepotism, we have Eric Watts up next facing Pat Rose. And Tony Schiavone says that we'll be talking to Eric Watts later. And oh boy, that ought to be fun. And Eric Watts is kind of the classic example of when nepotism goes wrong. Also a son of a guy who is running the company, just as I had alluded to with Dustin Rhodes. He had teamed with Jushin Thunder Liger at Starrcade 92 and threw one of the worst drop kicks in history. I think it was in that match. I have not watched Starrcade 92 in my research for this. That's not a show that I really feel bad about not going back and watching. The bad drop kick is what Eric Watts is kind of known for. He had the bizarre thing with Arn Anderson, like I said, at the gas station as well. But they also would always talk about Eric Watts's football career. So I thought to myself, let's look at his performance. They even had the coach of Louisville, Howard Schnellenberger, who had made his name coaching Miami to their first national title back in 1983. But now he's at Louisville, which was an independent school, not part of any conference at that point. In 1990, that was a lot more common. And in that season, they actually finished with a record of 10-1-1, which was good for only 14th in the AP poll, in part because they weren't part of a conference, so therefore they had to play a lot of other independent schools, and consequently it was a bit of a weak schedule. I think they had a 10-10 tie against San Jose State in their opener, but they actually finished the season red hot with 7 consecutive wins, including a victory in the Fiesta Bowl over University of Alabama, which to this day remains their only victory over the Crimson Tide. They actually played them last weekend and lost. I think it was like 51-14. Was not even a close game. But that Fiesta Bowl was actually a bit controversial because that was when Arizona had refused to make the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday a state holiday as well. And as a consequence of that, a Super Bowl got taken away from them and moved to the Rose Bowl. That would have been Super Bowl 27, which was in January of 1993. But the thing I remember most about that game is on one of the touchdowns, I believe it was a guy on Louisville because it was 34-7. So it was probably one of their touchdowns. He ran at like full speed right into the goalpost as he caught a touchdown pass and then boom, right into the goalpost. That's the thing I remember about that game. I love how I can't remember what I had for lunch 2 days ago, but I can remember stupid stuff that happened in the 1991 Fiesta Bowl. But okay, back to Eric Watts. He was actually the backup quarterback on that team. Only had 2 pass attempts in that. He might have been the holder on field goals because he's listed as getting into games and all that. So, fine. After that season, Browning Nagel leaves Louisville off to conquer the National Football League, playing for the New York Jets moving forward. So how did Eric Watts do in 1991 when he took over as the starter, playing in 10 games that season? Well, Louisville kind of stunk that year, finishing with a record of 2-9. So they really bottomed out, and they did so in a hurry. But you could say, oh, well, it wasn't his fault, right? It was all their defense was lousy, and that's why they were losing games. Well, not really, because his completion percentage was well below 50%, as he completed 115 out of 260 passes. So that's about 44% for 1,294 yards. So he only averaged 5 yards per attempt, which is pretty lousy even for 1991. But here is his touchdown to interception ratio, which is really what got me. He threw 6 touchdowns, but threw 16 interceptions, which would get you benched in a heartbeat in today's not only like NFL, college football, a junior college, a high school team. It doesn't even matter where you are. And I don't mean to be quoting Jim Mora there. So not exactly the best career for Eric Watts in college football. Don't be fooled with what WCW is trying to present you by saying, oh, he was a good player. And I'm like, no, things did not work out for him well. And same for the beginning of this match, because Pat Rose actually controls early, but then Watts turns it around, probably an interception or whatever. Hip toss, a very low drop kick, so we do get the Eric Watts drop kick, and an elbow, which gets a 1 count. And then with his clothesline, I don't want to say that a clothesline is a way that you can judge a professional wrestler on his work, but you can just tell that he's not the natural one here. He's not the son of a son of a son of a son of a gun or anything like that. He just doesn't look natural doing what he's doing out there. And then he locks in the STF, which is perfectly fine. You don't get the best view of it, because anytime somebody is using the STF, I immediately want to judge it to see if he's locking it in tighter than any John Cena STF in the last 12 years, which I have, in order to say something good about Eric Watts, I will say that for all the criticism he might get as a pro wrestler, he did lock in his STF a little bit tighter than what John Cena would do, where you could literally drive Cadillacs between his arms and the guy's head, but okay, that's fine. There's only one problem, though, with this move, is that Watts' foot is under the ropes, so when the referee calls for the bell, I don't think that this match should have ended that way, because the hold should have been broken, but okay, fine. We're getting out of an Eric Watts match here, so that's okay. And they promised that he was going to talk to us. And I'm wondering, okay, you got Jesse talking to Eric Watts. I'm like, oh, is he going to try to show up the boss's son? Not really, because Jesse knows that in order to keep that paycheck coming in the way it has been since Kip Fry was in charge, you got to please the boss somehow. So he does put over Eric Watts somewhat in this promo and lets him have his way.
Let me tell you something, Eric Watts. I come down here to interview you because I hold your father directly responsible for what happened to Arn Anderson.
Well, hey, that's where you need to stop right there. My father has nothing to do with me. I'm a separate entity. I'm a man on my own.
Wait a minute. You're telling me that you don't do everything your daddy tells you to do?
Hey, that's where you need to shut up, buddy. Hold the mic like you were supposed to do. I need to tell you and the rest of the world a few things. I'm my own man. My dad didn't tell me when to wrestle, when to play football, basketball. He wasn't on the field when I was in Louisville. And he isn't in the field or in the ring with me. Arn Anderson is a man on his own. And he came looking for another man. He told me he'd find me wherever I was. It happened to be at a gas station. Any of us could have been hurt. It just so happened to be him. But that's to send a message out to you and anyone else. Eric Watts is the easy man to find. Come get me wherever you want me and leave my daddy out of it, buddy.
I do think it's weird that he refers to his father as daddy, considering he's a full-grown man. But okay, I'll let that go. He's an easy man to find, but if you read his college football stats and extrapolate from that, he's an easier man to intercept. Annie Lennox with Walking on Broken Glass, which peaked at number one in Canada, but only got to number 14 in the United States. The video, kind of known for having both John Malkovich and Hugh Laurie in it, but I know that song for something else, because the summer that I worked at Toys R Us, which would have been 1996, so 3 or 4 years after the song came out, it was played incessantly when I'd be stocking diapers. It would drive me crazy until one kid who worked in the store made up a parody of it that was, smoking on, smoking on, smoking on crack. And then I recently, some 20 years later, have a conversation with my wife, and she says to me, why didn't you just change it to smoking on grass? And I thought, oh, yeah, that would make more sense. And also, as I said a few weeks ago, saying grass instead of marijuana is always funnier. So anyway, we go back to Uncle Eric with the WCW Magazine segment. He gets three of them during this show, and this is part two, and he's not even in power. So we're now joined by the saga of Vinny Vegas and his left-handed thing from the arm wrestling tournament. And Vinny here, in his pre-Diesel days, with the Vegas card shark character, or whatever it's supposed to be, just like a wise guy or something. I didn't quite understand what the character was supposed to be about. In part because I'm not sure he got a lot of promo time on WCW television at that point. Of course, that would change years later, for the worse, I might add. But on this show, if you ever want to hear Vinny Vegas talk, this is the show for you.
He beat me in the first round. But the thing is, everybody that knows Vinny Vegas knows, hey, I'm a lefty. The guy beat me on the... Hey, I used to be a pitcher. I was a lefty. And you can ask the girls in Vegas. They know I'm a pitcher, not a catcher, right? I'm a lefty. So, we're not going to have... I'm challenging you, Van Hammer. And it ain't going to be no little thing with sticks and cups and all this. It's going to be ballroom style with a table, a couple of chairs. We'll knock the drinks away and we'll go. Baby, this time you're going to see the Bin Man, the strongest arm in WCW.
Gotta love the pitcher-catcher gay jokes coming from a guy who is wearing pink pants at the time, but we'll put that aside for a second. Interesting how he uses the phrase big man to refer to himself, because that's how Scott Hall would refer to him when they show up in 1996, the big man and the medium-sized man. And Vinny Vegas actually is left-handed. Now, if you look at Kevin Nash's Twitter account, right now, it says left-handed right on there, but Jesse Ventura did not have access to such a thing back in the day. He would have had to have been told. So they play the clip of Vinny Vegas beating Tony Atlas left-handed at the Clash of the Champions, and believe it or not, we're going to get a little bit more promo time for Vinny.
Hey, I just beat the real competition. Hey, Buggy Whipline, I know you're at home watching. Hey, don't let me have to send my people to come get you, coward. Get on the table with the Bin Man. I'm going to put you down. This is the strongest arm in WCW.
Well, Vinny Vegas backing up his claim that he's left-handed by defeating Tony Atlas. And Vinny Vegas is looking forward to his shot at Heavy Metal Van Hammer, who has assured us that as soon as he gets the doctor's okay, he'll be at the table with Vinny Vegas in any kind of rules.
Even money that if Eric Bischoff is there, he ends up getting powerbombed through said table, even if it's just for arm wrestling. So, in case you wanted to know what Vinny Vegas would end up doing for the rest of his stay in WCW in 1993, yes, he took part in the TV title tournament, losing in the semifinals to Eric Watts, of all people. But he did defeat a young up-and-comer named Robbie V in the quarterfinals. Yes, Rob Van Dam, under an earlier gimmick name. And eventually, he would spend much of April and May losing to Van Hammer on house shows around the country before departing for the WWF in June. There's a couple of months where he's not working, and his first matches for the WWF were in six-mans alongside his good friend Shawn Michaels and maybe his not-so-good friend Bam Bam Bigelow on the house show circuit ahead of SummerSlam 93.
Hey, why'd you stop?
My lips feel dry and cracks. I need Blistex.
Blistex ointment is the only leading brand with moisture. Medicated Blistex with the advanced moisture system.
It's America's favorite crash dummies in their first NES and Game Boy video game adventure. It's a crashing, bashing good time guaranteed to crack you up by LJN.
I'm not sure when I checked out on Game Boy. It's probably before January of 93. I'm pretty sure I wasn't playing it at the end of middle school. I actually found my Game Boy not too long ago. Probably still had the batteries in it from the early 90s. I'm pretty sure it might work if I took them out of there and put new batteries in. But I'd certainly need to find my copy of Bo Jackson, the 2-in-1 game that he had. I think it was called Bo Jackson Hit and Run, just for the theme song so I could sing the song that I made up for it. Poop fart and a little shit, e shit. Poop fart and a little shit, e shit. Fart and a little shit, e shit. I got a poop fart and a little shit, e shit. I got a poop fart and shitty shit. I got a poop 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 poop. All right, you got it now. Jeez, that really takes me back to my childhood right there. Kind of emotional just singing that song once again. We got Barry Windham, who also had very interesting music at this time, coming out to a song that sounded like a mix of ZZ Top's LaGrange and Boston's Smokin'. But it was individualized because they would say his name, Barry Windham, in it. He is taking on Brad Armstrong in a battle of second-generation stars, and it kind of made me wonder, would I rather see Bullet Bob Armstrong taking on Blackjack Mulligan here? Well, not in 1993, since Blackjack Mulligan was... He wasn't even only off the golf course. This is after the prison stint for counterfeiting and all that. Bullet Bob still working, going strong in Smoky Mountain in January of 93. So, just kind of a good match thrown in here. As I said earlier in the show, Wyndham is on his way to winning the NWA title. The last worthwhile push of his career that he would have before he'd suffer the injury in 94 to his knees. And he would just never be the same, either because of injuries or because he just didn't want to be the guy that he was before. And there's really nothing wrong with that, because apparently he turned out okay in terms of, you know, financially, and he lives his life happily, and you don't hear anything bad about him. He may have put on a few pounds, but who among us has not? But we start out with a slam by Brad Armstrong. Actually got me thinking about Brad Armstrong, who was supposedly, you know, a bit of a cut-up in the back, kind of funny as hell. The fact that they never really found a character for him, and they tried all sorts of weird stuff, like Arachnaman and Fantasia and Badstreet, which is pretty much the same thing, and they change him into Badstreet to avoid copyrights. It might be a case of him being unable to do the character or translate that on stage the way he is in real life. I mean, that is a thing that can happen. But what I think with Brad Armstrong is that he has the disease of the good worker, for lack of a better phrase, where he's a very good professional wrestler, but because he doesn't have those little character instincts to put him over the top, he's on this level where he's going to be putting guys over for his entire career, and he's never going to quite get over the hump. It kind of just felt like he was stuck at that level in WCW. I mean, you think back to one of the early Clash of the Champions. He's going to a draw with Mike Rotundo in the opening match. I want to say it was Clash 2, and that's nearly 5 years before this. So to just think of him being stuck in that one spot, I think part of it owes to the fact that he was really good at what he did, and unfortunately some of that would be in terms of putting guys over. A side headlock takeover into a head scissors spot, and eventually there is a rope break. And all I could think was that these two guys are what Eric Watts isn't at this particular point in time. And you look at Brad Armstrong and you look at Eric Watts, and you can kind of see why some people might have been resentful of the push that Eric Watts is getting. But that's well-trod ground. I'm not saying anything particularly original there. Wyndham breaks clean in the corner, but instead of really breaking clean, he lays in a really stiff shot. One of those type of deals where you hit the guy in the chest and it just reverberates all over the arena in Alabama. And he follows it up with a back suplex. And Wyndham really wants somebody in the crowd to shut up. I had played that in the intro at the top of the show, where Jesse was convinced that he was yelling at Tony Schiavone to pipe down. But Wyndham kept turning back to the same person in the crowd in Alabama, and just, you know, was very, very concerned about that. He had a chop battle in the corner, and Brad ends up winning that. A hip toss, and then he drop kicks Wyndham, who falls to the outside. Back inside, get a foot up in the corner by Barry. Not a full SD Jones charge, but then Brad goes for a suplex to kind of quickly follow up on the failed move. And the counter, which I'm convinced, because they were battling for the suplex, which is always kind of a thing that I like, that I'm not sure I've seen much of it in modern wrestling. But instead of countering it into a vertical suplex of his own, Wyndham gets the front face DDT out of it. And that is how he picks up the win in this one. This one, in fact, I might have given them two or three more minutes, but I really like this one for a TV match. Am I going to rank it the greatest match under 7 minutes that I've ever seen? In fact, it might have been under 5 minutes. No, I'm certainly not going to do that. I mean, this wasn't Owen Hart versus 1-2-3 Kid at King of the Ring 94 or anything like that, but I particularly enjoyed it. And as always, whenever Jesse gets angry about the instant replay, I'm used to hearing it with him and Vince on Superstars, but once again, happens here with Tony.
Jesse, I'm going to be talking to Paul Orndorff. Why don't you go ahead and call this replay for me?
Oh, call it for you.
For me, yeah.
I call the replays, little man.
Yeah, but I tell you what to do.
Tony is with Paul Orndorff, and he has some words for Sting, which is your usual heel boilerplate. But I am much more fascinated with something else that he said.
I told you last week, Sting, that a very good friend of mine, Rick Rude, called me and told me the situation.
That is a real disappointment for those of us who want to keep continuity from 1987 WWF storylines. And I have to say, I am quite disappointed that those two eventually became friends. And I guess found common ground in being narcissistic about their bodies. I was hoping that they would feud forever as they were at the end of 1987. But okay, he moves on to other topics. And eventually, Harley Race joins Orndorff on the podium. And this basically turns into a good old-fashioned Heenan family hootenanny without Heenan.
Oh, I just want to come out here and tell you how happy I am from the bottom of my heart and the world's heavyweight champion, Big Van Vader, that you're here and you're in our camp.
You know, I'd play the Lord of the Rings clip again like I did a few weeks ago during the AWA show. I'm glad you came, Sam. In reference to what Harley Race is saying, but I'm afraid to do that because even though Harley Race might not be in the greatest health at age 75, I'm convinced he could probably still kick my ass.
Police Traditions, JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PoliceTraditions.com. We offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Police Tradition Wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, along with Main Event, Survey Says, the Monday Night Wars, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction show, as well as Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver special network podcasts and pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Match of the Week podcast, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Through the Years, Worldcast, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Center Stage, and Letters from Kayfabe, plus much more. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as Talkin' Pop, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, NBA Team, PTBN Play, Sunday Groove, Breaking Balls, and Lucha Undead,
as well as a vertical podcast heaven for comics fans
with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and Marvel Age Podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including the Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback today. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free BTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Boneheads Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and ahistoryofwrestling.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
February 21st, we have a date with destiny. Super Raw 3, the game becomes reality.
Vader's invitation to his unknown White Castle of Fear was quickly accepted by WCW's most popular athlete.
Sting says that he's not walking away from the White Castle of Fear, and all I can think is I'm going to run like hell away from it, because when I think White Castle, I think of food poisoning, and food poisoning is the absolute last thing that I want in my life. I've never actually eaten at White Castle. I know it best from that Harold and Kumar movie where they are really craving these little burgers, and then they get there and order 30 of them, and I can't quite comprehend how you can eat that many. I guess they're smaller than your normal burger that you would get at a place, but I don't know. It doesn't have the greatest reputation for having the best food. This is the Super Brawl 3 Control Center, so the production on this show has been very WWF-esque, and I mean that as a compliment. But one thing that WCW would do differently with Jim Ross here hosting this segment, not knowing that he's about to be reassigned in a few weeks, as it is in Turnerland, you never get fired, you get reassigned. Instead of having the actual TVs behind them, like in the WWF Event Center, here it's just sort of a cartoon of TVs and this one reel that goes around and around that I really enjoy. The effort that they put into that, it's quite a lot of fun, in my opinion. And good old JR runs down the matches for this show, including Barry Windham versus the Great Muta, who, as I said, last two guys in Battle Bowl from Starrcade 92. So they actually show a clip of the end of Starrcade, which it sees Muta skinning the cat, although it was not done in the usual way. It almost looks like he went over at a tighter turn radius than a guy normally would, almost as if he was afraid his feet were going to hit the floor just from going over normally and skinning the cat, Shawn Michaels or Ricky Steamboat style. And he ends up eliminating Wyndham to win. And you get the voiceover explaining the stakes here. So this is very good TV. This is WWF-style packaging that you would see later on. So I don't know why WCW kind of lost its way later on. Oh, wait, I know. It's because the damn people in charge would change all the time. And I'm not sure how much of a commitment there was to maintaining this type of quality. Also, on Super Brawl 3, it's very interesting. The Smoky Mountain tag titles were on the line with the Rock and Roll Express taking on the Wrecking Crew, who is the team that I described when I did the other WCW 1993 show as the most 93 WCW team you could find. And they show a clip of the Rock and Rolls versus the Midnights from 1990, because you can't go wrong showing that. But it's just interesting that Smoky Mountain managed to kind of worm their way into WCW at the end of the Watts era, and then end up with the WWF late in the year. And the commonality is that Jim Ross is there both times. Of course, he would become associated with Smoky Mountain Wrestling as a broadcaster later on. One thing, when they show the clip of the Midnights and the Rock and Rolls, I was kind of amused because I am pretty sure that the person pronounced Jim Cornette's name incorrectly.
Let's take a look at Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson, the legendary Rock and Roll Express, in action against their longtime nemesis, Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express from 1990.
Who is this Jim Cornette you speak of? Is it the dad of former Washington Capitals legend Chris Cornette, who played 8 games in the 2001-2002 season and picked up his only assist to make it 6-3 on a Chris Simon goal in a game that ended up 11-5 against Ottawa back in November 2001? Sorry, I remember that game very well, because you don't forget a game where the final score is 11-5. But yeah, Jim Cornette's name said wrong, and this is probably one of his last appearances on WCW television, I would reckon. I can't really see much reason why they would show him even in file footage from that point forward. But my point is that this is proper promotion of a pay-per-view. This is shocking to see from WCW, and I really like it. I kind of wish they would have stayed the course, but instead we had to have Bill Watts give an interview from 2 years before. I'm not saying that Mark Madden shouldn't have ratted him out to Hank Aaron and all the Turner people about the things that he said. I mean, what he said was not a good thing by any means, but I do kind of wish that we could have gotten to see where WCW was going under Watts a little bit longer into 1993. Yeah, give us another 3-4 months. If I have my time machine, I'll go back and tell Mark Madden, look, I know you want to get this guy in trouble and you want to get him fired, but please, just give this about 4 or 5 more months and you're free to do whatever you want, because I want to see where this is going. I mean, like I said, the TV here, they're actually promoting the pay-per-view properly. So what if the buy rate was only 0.50 and only one-third the number of buys of the 1993 Royal Rumble for Super Brawl 3, which would be the comparable pay-per-view for, you know, the time of year? They're heading in sort of the right direction, at least. Ric Flair's coming in. All's going to be right with the world. Have you talked? Sorry, Jamie Walters. You are always Ray Pruitt to me. You're the guy who pushed Donna Martin down the stairs in Palm Springs. And let me tell you something else. That would have been maybe okay if it was her Saved by the Bell character, Tori Spelling Saved by the Bell character, because I find her to be way worse. But that's a subject for another time. Already in the ring, kind of interesting, as the tag team champions, Ricky Steamboat and Shane Douglas, don't even get an entrance for their match here against Tex Slasinger and Shanghai Pierce, the future Godwins. And we learn very early that Brian Pillman and Stunning Steve Austin, the yet unnamed Hollywood Blondes, have issued a challenge to the tag team champions for a match on Worldwide next week. So we'll hear from Steamboat and Douglas after this match as to whether they accept. Tony and Jesse have a rather interesting conversation about good old Tex and Shanghai, debating whether this is Jesse's bit here, and I don't quite understand it. I know it's a portmanteau of Texans and Mexicans, but they have this debate over whether those two guys are Texicans.
Two big men, Texans, and certainly they're going to pose a real...
No, Shimani, Texican.
Texans, Jesse.
Texicans. I've told you that time and time again.
Look at this.
I'm not sure if that's just a slowly developing bit where he's going to go someplace with it, or just a continuation of his Tito Santana thing from the WWF, making fun of Mexicans, or, you know, just a continuation of his obsession with Mexico and why, you know, Jesse Ventura actually lives down there now. Douglas ends up in trouble right from the get-go, so proceed directly to this heat segment. Do not pass go. Do not collect $200. But he counters with a head scissors, and then he starts working the left arm. And thankfully, Jesse goes back on the Texicans thing.
And they're in bad mood. You know why, Shivani, those Texicans?
I'm sure you know why, Jesse.
Because they all thought Texas A&M was the best team in the country till Notre Dame kicked their butts a few weeks ago.
Not only is this episode going to set a record for the most 90210 talk, but also the most college football talk, because that Cotton Bowl played on January 1st, 1993, one of the last Cotton Bowl games that actually sort of meant something, because that was fading as an entity in the early 90s, because it was attached to the Southwest Conference, and that was a conference that would eventually go away in the 90s realignment of the conferences. You might be more familiar with the more recent realignments of jumping of conferences of Maryland in the Big Ten, which I still can't quite wrap my head around that. But Notre Dame playing Texas A&M was actually rather controversial at the time. You might wonder, well, Notre Dame was actually number 5 in the country with a record of 8-1-1, actually 9-1-1 going into that game. And Texas A&M was 4th in the AP poll, but they were 12-0 on the season. So the thought was it would be better if they had played number 3 Florida State, because the number 1 and 2 teams were committed to other games. That would be the Sugar Bowl between Alabama and Miami, which Alabama thumped the Hurricanes 34-13 in that one. And whoever won that game was going to win the national title. Texas A&M didn't have a chance unless they really blew out who they were playing, and the other game featured, you know, just some bad football and ended up like 10-7 or something like that. Notre Dame was chosen mainly because of ticket sales for the Cotton Bowl, because like I said, it's kind of fading as an entity, and also the game was being televised on NBC, which is a broadcast partner of Notre Dame football starting in 1991. Back then, Notre Dame had Rick Meyer as their quarterback, who would go second in the 93 NFL draft, and Jerome Bettis, the Bus, was also in the backfield for the Fighting Irish. On defense, they had Demetrius Dubose, who you may not remember, but he was a pretty good college defender, and dominant 28-3 win over Texas A&M, which I remember very, very well, doing the bowl pool that I would fill out on my mother's behalf for the teachers in the city that I lived in. I picked Texas A&M, and it was one of those picks that I just kind of regretted. Now, we had Shane Douglas in trouble for a little bit earlier. Now, as God intended, we have the Ricky Steamboat heat segment, and they are focusing on his ribs, hitting him with a gut buster. And, you know, these two guys cut off the ring effectively. They could make good hog farmers at some point down the road. And at one point, one of them runs over and suckers Douglas on the apron and draw him into the ring. So now the referee has to pay attention to him. I'm like, boy, these guys are all right. Get a backdrop, but Slazenger then puts his head down, a cardinal mistake for a ring veteran. Steamboat then tries to follow up with a clothesline, but then they end up clotheslining each other, and Steamboat eventually crawls over and makes the hot tag to Shane Douglas, who, as a babyface, I'm not quite a fan of Shane, because there's something about him in doing like babyface stuff where it seems very paint by numbers, almost like he had just read an instruction manual of how to be a proper babyface and he's trying to follow it to the letter without making any mistakes. I feel like maybe in a prior era, like in the early 80s or late 70s, that would have worked better for him. But as the 90s roll around, you can kind of gather that maybe he would be best off as a heel. Steamboat actually presses Douglas over his head and drops him on Slazenger, but the pin is broken up. And eventually, Shane gets caught by Slazenger, kind of holding him in his arms, almost like he's in a power slam position. But at that moment, with the referee's back turned, Steamboat comes off the top with a cross body and kind of knocks Douglas into Slazenger, and that is how they pick up the win. So, bit of a convoluted finish, but a nice win for the tag team champions over the future Godwins here on WCW Worldwide. And after the match, they would accept the challenge of Pillman and Austin for the following week. And in my head, I had it that these guys would lose the titles to them at that next week's Worldwide, but that was not the case. In fact, the Hollywood Blondes did not win the tag titles until the March 27th episode of Worldwide, which was taped about 3 weeks earlier in March, and they would hold those titles through August, finally losing them to the Horsemen team of Arn Anderson and Paul Roma.
Welcome to the final edition of this week's WCW Magazine, and you're looking at the cover of the most recent edition of the WCW Magazine, and it is available at newsstands nationwide. We urge you to pick up your copy.
It's interesting that it took until the third WCW Magazine segment for them to actually promote what was going to be in the magazine. When you look at the cover, it's not necessarily one person they're trying to promote. There's probably about 10 or 12 guys on the cover. It seems to be something of an awards issue for 1992, as Marcus Alexander Bagwell had won Rookie of the Year. I always remember him as being Rookie of the Year in 1991, but that's not correct. He was in Global Wrestling Federation down in Texas, which I should remember because that makes sense, because Jeff Bagwell was the National League Rookie of the Year for the Houston Astros. That's kind of a mnemonic I can use to remember that. Eric Watts, they mentioned, was actually the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Rookie of the Year, which is just hilarious when you think back on that. And then a couple of the awards that I always liked in PWI, but apparently they had in WCW Magazine as well, the most popular and the most hated. Those always kind of meant a lot to me as a kid. It would always give me like a feel for where everything was. And most popular in WCW, no surprise, was Sting. And after him, I was very interested that number two was Ricky Steamboat. And that's really not much of a surprise. But number three was Nikita Koloff, who hadn't even wrestled since Halloween Havoc 92, losing to Big Van Vader there, and Dustin Rhodes is fourth. You would have thought that they might have gimmicked the results so that the guy who was still active would finish ahead of Koloff, but maybe they did it legit, who knows. And on the most hated side, you had Ravishing Rick Rude at number one, which he also won the Pro Wrestling Illustrated Award for Most Hated for 1992, followed by Vader, Jake the Snake Roberts. There, that number three spot seems to be reserved for guys who are no longer in the promotion. I mean, Jake was barely there for a couple of months. And Cactus Jack finishes fourth, which is funny because he's just turned babyface at the Clash of Champions about a week and a half before this. So I'm not sure that that was entirely planned because, as I said earlier, that was kind of an organic face turn. And to wrap up this show, very similar to the last WCW 1993 show that I did, we have a promo from Brian Pillman and Steve Austin. Pillman goes first and, dare I say, actually makes a very good point.
We knew they'd accept the challenge, and what a sad irony it will be when you look back at the storybook career of Ricky Steamboat, at the great achievements of Shane Douglas, and you realize that these two will be best remembered as the team that launched Stunning Steve and Flying Brad on the road to tag team immortality.
That is true. They would win the tag team titles from those guys. And Austin and Steamboat are linked, not just because it was Austin who hit Steamboat in the back of the head with one of the title belts, thereby creating the victory for the Hollywood Blondes to win the tag team titles, but Steamboat's last match at the Clash of Champions in 1994 was against Stunning Steve Austin, so he actually closed out his career there. I'm not going to mention the 2009 comeback. Obviously, he was still very good at that point, but I'm talking about in his main run. So Austin, he gets a chance to speak now. And I had mentioned this when they had their promo in that June 1993 WCW Saturday Night Show, where you can hear the glimpses of Stone Cold occasionally in what he is saying. He kind of sounds like himself, but here in January of 93, you can tell he's still trying to figure it out.
Oh, are these two guys stupid? Steamboat and Douglas. Okay, Hotshot, you could have come out here and said no to the challenge, done the smart thing, and declined the offer. I don't know what you're thinking. The people out here, these common, everyday 9-to-5ers, actually think you can beat us. It's not going to happen. Me and Brian rule the tag team world.
And that is where I thought that they were going to wrap for this episode of WCW Worldwide for January 23rd, 1993. But wait, there's one more promotional consideration just around the bend.
You know, I enjoy performing, but I also enjoy working out. That's why I go to General Nutrition Centers and get Cybergenics Phase 1. Hey, if this guy can do it, you can do it. Get Cybergenics at GNC.
The Murine Earwax Removal System has drops that safely loosen wax, plus an ear washer to gently flush wax away. Murine, the complete medically approved earwax removal system.
Quite frankly, I'm down more with the earwax removal ad than Joe Piscopo for Cybergenics, which to me just always kind of strikes me as IcoPro by another name. As IcoPro, really big here in 1993. I actually found a story from the Orlando Sentinel that gave mild insight into Joe Piscopo's psyche and why he became all into like working out and stuff. Pumped up comic Joe Piscopo says his divorce-inspired fitness kick helped him land a role as a pitchman for nutritional supplements. I don't quite understand why this article capitalized the H in him as if Joe Piscopo himself is God. But anyway, the former Saturday Night Live regular said he began hitting the gym years ago to ease tension from the divorce and ensuing custody battle. Piscopo, 41, was previously a spokesman for Miller Lite Beer. Now he's plugging the Cybergenics products made by Pittsburgh-based General Nutrition, Inc., which operates stores in shopping malls. And, of course, that's where you're going to find all your best nutritional supplements, is right around the corner from the food court at your local mall. Still have a couple of pieces of business I want to get in real quick. With the NFL season starting tonight, as a matter of fact, in Philadelphia with the Eagles and the Falcons, just want to get in three quick picks for this weekend's NFL games. Number one, the Steelers are at Cleveland and are only giving 4 points. Now, I know Le'Veon Bell is not playing for the Steelers because he's holding out because of the whole franchise tag and all that. But even keeping that in mind, the fact that you're only having to give 4 points with the Steelers at the Browns in week one feels like something of a bargain, so I'll take that and run. Also, the New York Giants are hosting the Jacksonville Jaguars. I like to look at teams with new coaches, and while I'm not particularly impressed with some of Pat Shurmur's work dating back, he's sure a hell of a lot better than Ben McAdoo, and it's not going to be the complete craziness that it was last year, and I have to think that the Giants are going to be a little bit better. I also don't like how Jalen Ramsey has been running his mouth quite a bit recently. I love his bit about how if he spent 6 months learning how to skate, he could make the NHL. I find that very hard to believe, and the Giants are getting 3 points at home against the Jaguars, so I will take them there, and I will take the other New York team, and I'm not just saying that because this is Rosero's team, the New York Jets, getting 6.5 points against the Lions. People always say, oh, the Patriots, they've been great for so many years because the whole rest of the AFC East stinks. No, what the actual fact there's usually two teams in the AFC East who are not good, and there's usually one team that rises up to that 8-8, even as much as 10-6 level, and maybe steals a wild card, like the Buffalo Bills did last year, finishing 9-7 and getting the second wild card. I could actually see the Jets stealing the first or second wild card this year. I'm not sure if they can push the Patriots quite yet, but I see them playing a strong game against the Lions here, and at least covering the 6.5 that's there. I'm also not particularly thrilled with Matt Patricia, the new coach of the Detroit Lions, given that he's the defensive coordinator of the Patriots the last few years. And so his last performance kind of, you know, stays in my head at Super Bowl 52 when they couldn't stop a single thing that the Philadelphia Eagles were doing. So the three picks for this week: Pittsburgh -4 at Cleveland, New York Giants +3 versus Jacksonville, and the Jets +6.5 against the Detroit Lions. That is the Monday night game, the early game at 7:10 Eastern Time. Now, what you've been waiting for, another exciting edition of YouTube Comment Theater. Now, this one has been up for over a year, so there's 27 comments as I am recording this. And as always, these are actual comments made by YouTube users over the many months that this has been posted. Start out with Gilbert Syndrome. WCW were light years ahead of WWF in the early 90s. I would say from 92 to 96, it just comes down to a personal preference, because both of them would have their struggles, both of them would have their strengths. I think early 93 was actually kind of a fun time for WCW. I would rank them a little bit ahead of the WWF at that point. But, you know, it kind of depends. I'd almost have to go month by month and just kind of comparing the two. Joshua Wood Vivian says, I remember watching this episode on ITV here in the UK when I was about 7. First time I heard of the Great Muta and Too Cold Scorpio. Assumed the latter was something to do with Sting. It's amazing how first impressions can make such a difference. I mean, obviously, the Shockmaster later in 1993 would make one hell of a first impression in the other direction. But when you see the Great Muta for the first time, a lot of us saw him in 1989 as this sort of revolutionary figure, and you just sort of never forget it, and you maintain this fondness for this guy that lasts until the end of time. It can make a huge difference. I do think that just because a guy comes out doesn't get like a huge pop the first time. Usually when somebody's making a debut, there is not much noise made by the crowd or anything like that. So really, you know, don't worry too much about things like that. Bill Smith says, Orndorff, best pile driver ever. By the way, best clothesline ever when he turned on Luger. I love this. I like how Bill Smith here got Lex Luger confused with Hulk Hogan, which is an actual problem that would plague Vince McMahon later in 1993 when he put Lex Luger on a bus and was clearly confusing him for Hulk Hogan. That's really the only, explanation I have for all of that. James Muller says, Jesse Ventura said in a Howard Stern interview he walked away from wrestling in 1990 and never looked back. Then what is this? Yeah, Jesse probably just kind of forgot about his WCW days. It was said that maybe he left because he had fallen asleep at a taping in 1994. I don't know the real story. I tend to doubt that, but Jesse probably didn't go into chapter and verse in the Howard Stern show, because I've listened and Howard does not really care about pro wrestling. For as much as the Whack Packers were involved in it in the late 90s with, you know, Beetlejuice was on one of the shows, and Nicole Bass, who I think later became a Whack Packer and then of course passed away either earlier this year or last year, being involved in ECW in like 1998. So, you know, I wouldn't take the Howard Stern interviews, you know, as absolute gospel. It's not like he swears them in and they're under oath or anything like that. James Muller is very concerned with Jesse again, says, why are Jesse's eyes all squinted? I never saw him like that in the WWF, and he's not like that now. I don't know. I never really noticed him squinting his eyes. Maybe it was a little bright in the arena. I am not sure. Bill Smith Yen says, "Oh crap, I'd forgotten all about Van Hammer. I wish you wouldn't have reminded me." And yes, that goes back to what I was saying earlier on and how you can't find much unanimity on anything these days in this culture. But I think when you take the greater wrestling community as a whole, you get almost near unanimity, like 98%, that Van Hammer was just not very good at the thing called professional wrestling. That'll do it for YouTube comment there. As I've mentioned, I am going to New Mexico next week. However, there will be a show on Thursday on the feed, so be on the lookout for that. I'm going to be recording stuff for that right after I'm done with this. It's going to be slightly different, and in my intro, as I alluded to early in this show, I'm going to explain the unique circumstances that led to that episode coming to be. And oh boy, I can't really wait to get into all of that. Thank you so much for listening, and be sure to give a 5-star review to Greetings from Allentown and the Pro Wrestling Only feed on Apple Music / iTunes. That is always appreciated. Shop with the Place to Be Nation at placetobenation.com/Amazon and make all your Amazon purchases through there. I know I might want to pick up a few more Kindle books since I'll have a lot of time on the airplane, since it's not like you can get a direct flight to New Mexico from Boston. You either got to fly through Dallas or Atlanta. I forget which way. I think I'm flying through Dallas going there. It's the first time I've ever flown on American Airlines, which should be kind of funny. And I hope nothing happens to my plane, because then the next Thursday's podcast would be the first posthumous podcast ever released on the Pro Wrestling Only feed. I'm pretty sure that that is the case. So do tune in next Thursday for another exciting episode of Greetings from Allentown.
Pitcher, not a catcher, right?